to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating the West Virginia people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now, here's your host, Wayne Bennett. What you were doing to me just ain't right to make me
feel so bad. Welcome to Wayne Bennett's Podcast. I'm your host, Wayne Bennett. And this is episode 137. It's April the 24th, 2024 is the day we're taping it. And today we have the Sheriff of Raleigh County, Jim Kennedy. How you been?
I'm good. Good, Coach. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, the song that Eric Clapton had, I Shot the Sheriff, that's not one of your favorites, is it?
No, it's not. Actually, and we were talking before the podcast, one that comes to mind is Bruce Springsteen and Glory Days is actually one of my favorite. You know, I like to talk about the past. I know that you're a history guy, and, you know, we've got a bunch of 80s songs that I think I identify with, but that's certainly not one of them.
Well, the name Jim or James Kennedy, over the years, when you get as old as I am, there was a Jim Kennedy that ran for mayor of Leicester way back when. There was a James Kennedy that ran for the Board of Education. He lived around the MacArthur area. And then I remember probably in the late 1990s, there was a young man, James Kennedy, that was killed in a car wreck right up around MacArthur. Do you know any of those people?
I don't know any of those people. My dad's family is from the Surveyor area, so the Leicester part probably, and really everywhere may have a kinship, but the Leicester part especially. You mentioned the person that was killed. I do remember that. It's funny. I was talking to Jackie Shively just recently, and I remember at the time that there was a lot of people thought that was me, and yeah. My mom had gotten phone calls. This was obviously before Facebook and social media and all that stuff, but my mom had gotten phone calls. I think I was actually at a hunting camp at the time that happened for some reason, and she'd gotten phone calls and calls of condolences, so that was, you know, she had to kind of spread around that it wasn't me. But then I walked back into school one day, and I remember Jackie Shively going through the halls, just ran up and hugged me, and she started crying. And I talked to her recently about that, and we laughed about it. It's a tragic scenario, but, you know, just the time that people thought that was me. And I remember where that happened. It was in the curve as you're right below Vasilio and Grogan, I think.
Well, your mom and dad both were from Surveyor?
No, just my dad. My mom was actually from McDowell County. She passed away in 2017, but my dad was from Surveyor Tollytown, and his brother, and actually went to Trap Hill High School.
When I was writing for the newspaper early, I used to get a letter from a guy from Tollytown, and he was a comical guy. I can't even remember his name now, but this is before we had the internet much, and he used to write me a letter weekly and talk about wrestling a little bit. I know you grew up and went to the Crab Orchard Baptist Church. Shirley Donnelly was a preacher there for a long time, and talk about a historian. The guy, he was probably long gone before you came around, but he had an article in the paper every day. Yesterday and Today was the name of the column, and he talked about local history. Then when I worked out at Webb's Florist at Crab Orchard, the Fitzpatrick family was huge in the Crab Orchard Church, may still be, I don't know.
They're actually my family.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
So my grandmother was a Fitzpatrick, and Rondy Webb had Webbs at the time, but my great aunt Helen Fitzpatrick was the one that ran it. She was married to my grandmother's brother, and so I grew up on the Fitzpatrick family farm. My dad still lives there. It's parceled out now. Amongst the children and grandchildren of John Fitzpatrick. But yeah, I still go to Crab Orchard Baptist, and the Fitzpatrick family were my family's, some of the charter members of the church way back when, but I'm out of that group.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I work for Helen, and of course Rodney was still there, the guy that owned it. But then Dale Fitzpatrick and Steve Fitzpatrick played football and wrestled a little bit for me, you know, later. I guess Steve was probably around when you were around, wasn't he?
And actually, he lives there now on the farm. Steve and I were, and still to this day are close, kind of grew up together. But yeah, he lives there. Dale's dad, we call him Big Dale, lives there. And actually, Little Dale, who is the Dale that you're speaking about, has three kids, one of which is, well, two, they're involved in sports, but one of them has just wrestled for Independence and really did pretty well.
Yeah. Now, you played sports when you were younger. What all were you involved with?
I was good at baseball. I wrestled, and that was not one of my finer moments. I played football and actually played on Park's undefeated team. And those were really the three sports that I did the most. I wrestled some. Mainly everything was to stay in shape for baseball. Wrestling was a difficult cardio sport, and that helped cardiovascular-wise. Football, of course, was strength and conditioning, too. But my sport was really baseball, and I played that really from, I guess, five or six, whenever you started out in T-ball, all the way up through high school. And then my knee kind of gave out on me, and my career came to a crashing halt. So,
when you were in junior high there at Park, and we had an undefeated football team, had an undefeated wrestling team, mm-hmm. and you had, there were some pretty good athletes at that time. A buddy of mine was telling me a story about a win that you had in wrestling that you couldn't remember what you'd used or something.
Oh, that was my only win in wrestling, Coach. I remember it very well. And do you remember the cowboy?
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think John and I had worked around with it in practice. And like I said, I wasn't very good. And so I thought, what the heck? I'm going to try it. And I did. And I still remember it quite often. I had the guy pinned, but I couldn't get one of his shoulders down. And you kept saying, move around and get points, move around and get points. So I moved around and was getting points. And actually, at one point, I lost the hold and he got up. So I won that, I think, by decision. Because of the points that I had gotten, I never could get his shoulders down. But yeah, I did win quite a few by, I guess, default, whenever nobody was in my weight class to wrestle. But that's probably the one that he's talking about, because honestly, that's the only one I could remember.
Are you, when you got in high school, what were you involved with in high school?
A lot of the social aspect. I tried to play ball, but that was when my knee was going bad, going out. So I that's about when my career in baseball started winding down. I still played a little bit of baseball on the side, pickup games, church softball. I think I played a couple of years still in Babe Ruth, but I had been a hind catcher for, and a hind catcher, that's an older term, but that's where the bigger guys went because, you know, we could stop the ball. Yeah. And now they're so much more athletic, but it was just years and years of doing that. And I just started having knee problems. So I moved to third base, played a lot of third base, and then occasionally I would play some first base. So never was really fast. I was more of a power hitter. I had to hit it a long way to give me time to get to the bases.
Now, you graduated from Woodrow in 1989. Now, I know you didn't actually start with the Sheriff's Department till 2000. What did you do in between?
I was almost like a little bit of finding my way. I knew early on, if you remember the CTBS test that we used to take way back when, I think it was those tests would try to give you some kind of direction that maybe the things that you were predisposed to do. So I knew early on that I wanted to be in law enforcement. That's kind of what the test recommendations were, not that they meant anything. And I had family in law enforcement. So in my heart, I'd always known that this is what I wanted to do. So I tried to live my life along those ways. And so I went to college. It was always really important to my parents that I have a college degree. And I was the first one in my family. My sister's since graduated, but that I had a college degree. So I went to Concord. My wife and I were not married at the time, but we were together then. We both went to Concord, and I went into business and still had one foot always in the hole that I wanted to be in law enforcement, but tried to get away from it because I thought it was difficult to make a living, to raise a family. And later on, whenever my wife and I were first married, I still wanted to go into law enforcement, but you know, the shift work and the stress, and it's tough being married to a policeman. I mean, she's been my rock for years. And I think anybody that's in this job will tell you that it's difficult and it's hard on a family. But we were first married and she wasn't really comfortable with it. So I went to work. I worked as a merchandise buyer for Lily's Jewelers for a little while. And I spent some time. I started out with life insurance with New York Life and eventually kind of evolved my career into more investment advising. I had my securities license and kind of, I guess, put all that together. I had insurance, disability, but also if you wanted to invest, I could do that. Kind of help folks build a financial plan for their life. And just really couldn't get away from the law enforcement. So had a conversation with my wife and she basically gave in. She said, you know, you're not going to be happy. And we were comfortable enough, I think, in our marriage and our relationship to feel like we could withstand the rigors of a law enforcement career. So I started with law enforcement in 2000, actually a little bit before. I tested, I think, with the sheriff's department in October of 99. And by the time I was hired, it was May of 2000.
When you went to Woodrow and at Concord, was there any particular teachers that stand out that you might have had an influence?
Oh, wow.
Or somebody you just liked?
You know, I can even go back further than that, Coach. When I was in grade school, there were a couple. There were Jackie Mehta's and Helen Shoemate, both of them at Crab Orchard. June Willis was another one. And I went to church with those folks, so I not only got to see them as teachers, but I got to see them as people, you know, in church on Sunday. And they had the discipline there. The life lessons and the personal accountability, especially that those teachers caught. And that was back in the days whenever, you know, Jackie Mehta's or Helen Shoemate would come up behind you and you were doing something you weren't supposed to be doing. They'd whack you on the hind end with a paddle or smack you with their hand. And then at Park, and it's funny you mentioned, I talk a lot about my wrestling career, but that's one of the things that you had an influence in, that you taught a lot of patience and you taught young men how to be young men, whether it was on the football field or on the wrestling mat. And I really felt like that you cared as a person. And then when you get to Woodrow, there was Coach Culicerto, who was the football coach at the time. And I didn't do football at Woodrow, but Coach Culicerto also had that same ability to talk to you. And it kind of transcended a student teacher, but more person to person relationship. And I think that showed there's a whole lot of life lesson to be taught outside of books in school. And that's some of the things that I learned, I think, when I was in the public school system. And then when I got to Concord, my views are typically very conservative. I'm, you know, Christian and conservative and all those things. But I had a professor at Concord, Dr. Ron Berger, who was the most liberal person I have ever met. And proudly so, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but he and I just had differing philosophies. But he was such an impact. The most difficult classes I think that I've ever taken were Dr. Berger's classes. They were communication law. But I was also on Baptist Campus Ministries at Concord. And to give you an example of what I mean with Dr. Berger, he was an atheist. He was an avowed and proud atheist. But we went to the student government at Concord through Baptist Campus Ministries and asked for money, I think, to go to a conference or something. And the student government declined that. Well, Dr. Berger took up our cause and was our, I guess, for lack of a better term, our defense counsel, and actually fought for us to get money funded through the Student Government Association to go on a Christian outing. And he didn't believe anything about it. You know, he would personally, if we were talking, he would throw jabs at folks that were Christians or whatever, but so much believed, I think, in the sanctity of government and everybody having a voice that he took up our cause and really helped. So that's always been an impression on me as well.
You got married before you became a deputy. What does your wife do? Christy, is that her
name?
Yep,
Christy. What does she do? She's an accountant for the government. We have two children, Brandon and Allison. They're twins. They both just turned 18 and they're seniors at Woodrow this year. So in everything else, we're going through senior years.
You got your hands full now.
Yeah.
Now I knew your, do they both run track?
No, my daughter does not. My son runs. He runs track and cross country. And it's funny. I know we talked about Park, but I would always, when he was going to Park, I would say, hey, look at my picture in the trophy case where I was on that undefeated football team. So, you know, I was undefeated. So he actually won the county championships 2 years in a row, and they took my picture down and put his up as the county champion at Park. So,
well, I've been reading a little bit about him, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of my career running in high school. He's been through the injury bug. He's been fighting it for a couple of years, and when I was a junior in high school running track, I had was having a great season and got to the regional meet and pulled a quad muscle. And I ran and I qualified for the States, but I had my leg taped up so tight, you know, and I just couldn't do it. And it really was disappointing. Well, that summer, and that they started cross country at Woodrow that fall that I was there as a senior. And so I ran cross country. I was captain of the cross country team and had a great fall. Couldn't wait till track season was coming. And did well in cross country. And between cross country and wrestling season, I was playing sandlot football with some buddies and broke my ankle. Well, that 2.5 months doing nothing. You know, I mean, just I had my leg was in a cast, and I had a good senior season, but I think I could have had a great senior season. But it kind of made me hungry because I kept running after high school. I didn't run in college because I got married young, and I had to work and go to school too. But I continued running and ran roadway races and things like that up until I was 60 some years old, you know. And when I was 40, which I still say was the best shape of my life, I ran as fast when I was 40 years old as I did when I was a senior in high school. So I felt like that was accomplished. But I've been reading about him, and he's going to Concord, and Mike Cox is a great coach and great example. Mike was a tremendous runner himself, probably still is, but I just said I can identify. He may really come out up and get. I mean, it's not over yet, but yeah.
No, he's, and that's one thing that it's taught him, I think. And I've told him there's always a lesson to be learned. You know, you can train the body, but sometimes train the mind is a totally different thing. And, you know, you're at a point, or he was, that he had a decision to make, you know, do you quit or do you fight through it? And he chose perseverance. And I think that's, so the things that he missed out maybe whenever he was injured through running or the physical aspect, I think the character development, mental toughness really held through. And he, you know, he would go to meets. He stayed the team captain the whole time. He would go to meets. He very encouraging to his folks. And I think it was a big lesson for him, and I think one that will last. And it's funny, he'd talked to several schools. He tossed around. There was Marshall, and I think he was thinking about Davidson in North Carolina too. But Coach Cox really, again, on the personal level, sold the program. He wasn't so much, I don't think he had Division I aspirations a lot. He wanted the college experience, and sometimes you're locked in with the Division I. But we went, and my daughter's, they're both, my kids are very academically strong, but my daughter has wanted to be a doctor for years, and has kind of taken the advanced classes or whatever. They both have, but she's really tried to gear her scholastic career to be a doctor. So she actually made her decision to go to Concord before he had committed. We were on his official visit. She went with us, and Coach Cox was really good at talking with her as well and asked her what she wanted to do. And said she wanted to go to medical school. And he said, well, you know, we've got a 99% acceptance rate here at Concord to go into medical school. And, you know, on the spot, she was ready for Concord and very excited. And they both got academic scholarships there. She's earned the Scholars of Distinction. Of course, he's got an athletic scholarship as well. So it's been such a, we've been really blessed this year to watch your kids. You know, you don't want to live your life through them, but you're proud for them. And I think it's important, you know, they're coming into their own now and seeing how their hard work's paying off. And again, that's a life lesson.
Well, the thing about Concord is close to home, and right. You don't have to travel forever to get there or not just see them sparingly. You can run down there in 30 minutes now easily. And it's not bad. And it's a great school. Now you, after you became an officer, you got into the detective part. I remember seeing your name several times in the paper with Stafford, I think, was a partner.
He was, yeah.
And then you, I don't know, did you went to Cincinnati
I did. Actually, so when I was a detective, I worked and we were a smaller detective bureau then and didn't really have the staffing that we needed in the detective bureau. So Stafford and I, we were really close. He's passed away. And it's that one still stings as well. We talked about Coach Mahalik, but Dave and I were pretty close. But I went from the detective bureau. I went back on the road patrol for a little bit, and then I actually went in the drug unit. And we had our own drug unit at the time. It was just the Sheriff's Department drug unit. There were a couple of us. And we kept finding that we were tripping over. Beckley had a drug unit and State Police had a drug unit. And we were a lot of times burning the candle at both ends and meeting in the middle. So I worked with the leadership on from Beckley and from the State Police. And we formed now what's the Drug Task Force. And then I went in the Drug Task Force and I was actually undercover and then came out of that to be chief detective, which honestly was my career goal whenever I interviewed with the Sheriff's Department. And in the meantime, I wanted to get my master's degree from the University of Cincinnati because I think that it shows, or not so much shows, but for me, I wanted a deeper understanding of my craft, not just what I do, but what's the criminality, the criminal justice system? What makes that tick? How does that work? How does it come together? How does it play in the larger picture? So that was really, really beneficial, eye-opening. I think sometimes in academia, they call it the ivory tower. You have academics that teach out of books. And I felt like that I had the years of street experience to kind of combine the two. And I have no regrets. It's one of I think it's been great for my career. It's not something that I think that maybe helps you testify better in court, but certainly having a deeper understanding helps with this, with the explanation of it. So I was chief detective. And then when Scott was elected sheriff, he and I had worked together quite a bit and he asked me to be his chief deputy. So, but that was never on the radar. And certainly sheriff was never on the radar for me.
Do they still have a program? I taught a class at Beckley College back in late 70s, I guess, and maybe early 80s. And I had several guys that were in my class that were studying criminal justice through Bluefield State, I think. And actually half my class was deputies and policemen. I was a real popular guy in the county, you know, because I had all these guys in class, but do they still, and I think they were getting some help, incentive programs and stuff. Do they still do that?
The incentive programs?
Yeah.
We have not yet. The University of Charleston, I'm on the board of directors at the Sheriff's Association, West Virginia Sheriff's Association. The University of Charleston has a program now to where they will assist law enforcement with getting a bachelor's degree. It's basically, I think, almost like a Regents degree. You get so much credit for your time in service toward a bachelor's. And then they give a discounted rate for the classes that you still need. And then again, if you want a master's degree, I think they offer one in strategic leadership. So that's getting off the ground some. There are some sheriffs in the association that have done it. It hasn't caught on so much here. I've actually talked to President Stewart, West Virginia Tech here, West Virginia University Tech, and he's very interested in something like that as well, maybe getting it off the ground. And he said, and it's true, in order to make something like that, I don't want to say profitable, but doable, you need numbers.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just, you know, a lot of the guys that are working now or that start out in this, they either have degrees or they're just starting out with families. And it's just, you know, it's really difficult. You got small kids and you're going to baseball games and t-ball games or whatever. And plus you're working police work. That's a difficult commitment to make for 4 years to get a bachelor's or whatever it is. My master's was 2 years and that was, you know, that was difficult with small kids. So,
I guess online classes,
you can do, you can do some online classes with that. And at the Sheriff's Department, we do pay an incentive pay. You start out a little bit more if you have a bachelor's degree or a little bit more if you have an associate's degree. When I got my master's degree, I was probably one of the only ones. So it's really not, you don't ever get your money back in law enforcement, I think, as far as reimbursements or incentives for it. But and then we have training that's specific, and all law enforcement does that's specific to law enforcement. So I've had me personally, like advanced classes and interview. I used to run a lie detector test, so I, you know, advanced classes in that, and then evidence based classes like evidence collection or special weapons and tactics classes, SWAT team. We call them SRT, special response team. So there's a bunch of training that's specific, I think, to law enforcement that guys take advantage of. Seems to be more so than the academic stuff right now.
There's a lot of people out there, though, they don't realize the amount of training that you have to go through. And I mean, there's some people think that if you watch Andy Griffith's show 30 sometimes, you might be qualified to be the sheriff or something. But it is a lot more. But, you know, when I was in the eighth grade, we had to take the Golden Horseshoe test. And one of the questions was, what's the chief job of a sheriff? And the answer was that he's the chief tax collector in the county. And most people think law enforcement. Tell me a little bit about the tax collecting.
Well, I'll back up just a little bit before I get into that. It's funny you mentioned it. Actually, the qualifications to be sheriff are less than the qualifications to be a law enforcement officer.
Really?
There's a sheriff school that new sheriffs can go to, but really there are no qualifications to be the sheriff. You don't have to be a certified law enforcement officer. You don't have to necessarily have any idea how to, you know, the business aspect of being sheriff, which is honestly a big part. I remember when I was a kid, I saw somebody, and I have no idea who it was, running for sheriff. They weren't a police officer, law enforcement background, but they were a business person. And I'm thinking, what in the world's that guy thinking, you know? But you don't. I mean, to be a law enforcement officer, obviously you go through a pretty stringent, and we have a very stringent hiring process. It really hasn't changed much since I went through it. And then there's psychologicals and medicals, and then there's the physical aspect, and then you go to the academy, and then there's this physical and psychological aspect of that. Basically, if I hire a guy today, and we just hired a couple last week or conditionally hired, and they still have to do a medical and psychological, but you're really not very good as a policeman for about a year.
Wow.
By the time you go through all of the hiring process, then you're hired. Then you wait for an academy date. And our agency doesn't utilize, in a law enforcement capacity, new hires until they've been to the academy. They'll ride with somebody, or, you know, they can fill in as a bailiff or just general things like that. But as far as going out and answering a call by themselves, they don't. So we wait on the academy training. Then they come back from the academy, and we have a field training program that's somewhere 4 to 6 weeks. Could be longer or maybe a little shorter if somebody progresses quickly. And then even after that, you know, once you hand somebody the keys, you've given them all this authority. And sometimes they're fairly young folks. And one of the things that I try to stress is, of all the tools that you have on your tool belt or on your vest, the most important one you have is the one you got between your ears. So we like to try to teach decision making and discretion, but a lot of times that just comes with experience. You know, you've got to have done it. So it's about a year. And by the time you add salary and vehicles and training in, we've probably got close to $75,000 to $100,000 invested in somebody before they're ever ready or able to be a benefit in answering calls. So to your question as sheriff, the business aspect, so it's not just the tax collector. Actually, by code, the primary job of the sheriff's department in the state is not necessarily law enforcement. We're a function of the courts, an office of the court. So we in Raleigh County, we've been blessed and are big enough to offer the law enforcement services. And I think most sheriff's departments do, but some of the smaller ones, say a McDowell or a Mingo County, if they can't staff the courts, then all of their road patrol guys go to be bailiffs because that's the first responsibility. And then the state police or whoever else answers the calls. Now, we're the only countywide 24-hour operation in Raleigh County. State police are off at midnight. State police turnpike stay on full time. Of course, city's 24 hours in the city and some of the municipalities, but countywide, we're the only ones. But yeah, we're actually, our primary responsibility is not law enforcement, it's the courts. And the sheriff's job is not so much, so I don't set the tax rate. The assessor assesses the values. We just collect the money. And in that collection is also the treasurer of the county, which is probably just as equally important as the tax collector part. So I'm responsible for the county's money. And what that entails is the taxes that you're talking about, or say we just got, I think right around Christmas, about $3.5 million as an opioid settlement. So I'm in the office, you know, the Thursday or Friday before Christmas, because it just basically showed up, figuring out what to do with it. So what I try to do is try to keep an eye on what the Fed does. You know, do I think they're going to cut interest rates? Are they going to raise interest rates? We don't do any stock market investing, obviously, because there's no guarantees there. So I work with banks and I keep it local. You know, if I don't have somebody that I can't go to a branch and talk to, then we don't deal with them. So we work a lot with local banks and I try to get, you know, negotiate interest rates for, because sometimes it's a significant amount of money and because it's a significant amount of money, the banks are a lot of times better to work with interest rates. So we try to shop the interest rates around, manage it with what we think the Fed may do. Is a 6-month rate the best, or should we go with the 12-month because they're going to cut rates? So that's a very important part. And just,
do you have anyone that oversees you on that?
No.
You're the guy.
I'm the guy. Well, I mean, we all have a boss, right? So we're all either married or got kids or something. So we actually get audited. The auditor's office, state auditor's office, comes in and audits that thing, those things for us or for the county. But, you know, as far as the county commission telling me where to put money or the county clerk telling me where to put money, no, that's all the sheriff's discretion. And, you know, that's why it's so important. I think you'd mentioned the qualifications. That's why I think it's so important to have somebody that understands that kind of stuff, because it's not just, you know, you're sitting in an office somewhere. And whenever Scott was the sheriff, he and I worked really closely, and I was the chief deputy at the time, which meant that I was in charge of the law enforcement operations. And because he and I worked so closely, I had an idea of what he did or what was done. And we're also, you know, conservator or certain protected folks. Typically they're older, but sometimes they're mentally handicapped that can't make their own financial decisions. So the court will appoint me to basically take care of their finances. I don't make the medical decisions. Usually that's DHHR, but I'll make sure that if somebody's living in a house, their bills are paid, or sometimes they're in a nursing home and I have to sell their house to pay their nursing home bills. So those are all what I call the administrative duties of the sheriff that don't necessarily have anything to do with kicking the doors in.
Yeah. Before I forget, what have the old courthouse, when they had the jail upstairs, what have they done with the jails, the old jails?
Well, the jails are now Southern Regional. They're regional jails.
Yeah.
The state with the regional jails. But the upstairs part, if you go through the upstairs, and it's been through years of remodeling this and that, it's not really used for anything except storage.
I see.
So where the jails are or were upstairs, you can tell there were jails. And if you get some older folks in there, the older deputies or folks that work there, they can tell you, well, this was here and that was there. But it's primarily storage now.
Another thing, too, I don't want to forget. Does the county or region, since you've gone to regional jails, do they have any kind of work release anymore?
No, they don't have work release that goes necessarily outside the jail. I think the jail has trustees that do things within the jail, and occasionally you'll see a trustee that may come and do something, but we don't have the work release like they used to.
Yeah.
What we do have is through the day report center, and that's folks that are have been usually ordered or agreed to go to day report. Typically, it's drug-related crime, so they'll go there to get rehabilitation services. There are counselors there and whatnot. They do drug testing. And some of those guys will go help. You may see them out with litter control. The litter control officers, they'll be out, and they pick up a lot of trash throughout the county on the side of the road. So work release, which is a county organization, not a state one, but not work release, but day report, usually does what you're talking about with work release.
Yeah. When Scott Van Meter went took another position, and you were his handpicked choice to take your take his place. But it was up to the county commission. Of course, they approved you. But when was that? Was that 2022?
That was actually December 22. Scott had told me that he was going to. His parents were in. He's from Petersburg. Around the northern part of the state. And his parents were in ill health. His dad had since passed away. But he said he just, for family reasons, he felt he wasn't being fair to the sheriff's department or the county. And he told me that he was going to resign or was thinking about resigning. So I had some discussions with my wife. And, you know, like I said, it really never been on the radar. I was probably going to be content to finish out as chief deputy. But some of the work that we had started and the vision that we still had to go, you know, we brought the sheriff's department, and I say we because it's certainly not a one-man show. Scott was instrumental in that, and then I've got folks in command staff. But we've come so far, not with just the new building, but with the culture of the department and the pride in the department. We wanted to, I felt like that vision hadn't been accomplished yet, so I applied to be sheriff, and there were other folks, some running, that had applied to be sheriff. But I can't speak for the commission. I do know that I was selected unanimously, but I think they probably knew I'd worked with them closely. You know, we got a lot accomplished in a short amount of time. My business, I learned, is a relationship business. It took me a long time. I'm kind of thick with that. But basically what police work is getting people that don't want to talk to you to tell you something that they don't want to tell you. That's about the sums up police work. So you know, just working with the commission and having a dialogue with them, and I don't get everything I want and didn't, and they don't get everything they want. But there's a mutual respect and understanding there, and I think a trust. So we had started the new building. They really made an investment, I think, in our people with the new building, the sheriff's department, which is an investment in the county. We were changing the culture of the sheriff's department. When I started, Sheriff's Department wasn't allowed for a time to investigate felony cases. So we shipped everything to state police. And a lot of times in law enforcement, for whatever reason, it's just not right, but there's an ego thing involved. So we took a lot of pride in turning our department around to make it one that people would want to work for and one that was respected throughout the state. And we've made a lot of strides that way. So I just wanted to accomplish that vision that the county appointed me. I actually took over January 1st, 23. So I retired as a deputy, which I had to do to take over as sheriff. I technically retired on December 31st of 22. Department-wise, the years of service stay the same. Like, I've been working for the sheriff's department constantly since 2000. So years of service is 24, but I had to resign my civil service position as deputy to take what's an elected position as sheriff. So I started December 1st of 23. And, you know, it was just, for me, it was about as seamless as it could get because I knew the department, I knew the culture, I knew the people. A lot of them I've helped hire and either trained them or trained the people that have trained them. So there's a comfort level there, and there was a comfort level, I think, with the department. And we were just able to keep a steady ship, you know, continued to work with the commission. And one of the things that I'm most proud of, well, there's a couple. But I think through that relationship, if you look since 2017, which is when Scott was elected and I was appointed chief deputy, till today, we've raised the deputy's starting salary almost $20,000. So wow. I think that shows, you know, my most valuable resource as sheriff within the departments are people. And I think that's a valuable resource to the citizens of the county. If we can't hire and keep good people, then we're not effective in our mission. So we've been able to invest in them, to show a commitment to them. And I think the new headquarters goes a long way. We've got a great gym in there for them, which everybody loves, but especially the younger guys that are really into physical fitness. And so I think, you know, that's a relationship type business. And of course, we've got the new detachment that we're opening in Gent. We just broke ground on, and we'd had one in Glendaniel that's been so well received. And I think in the years past, I've said this, that we may not have been the best citizens in the community. And I think that the detachments show an investment both by the sheriff's department and the county commission to invest in the community and say, hey, you know, this is a service we want to offer. It's a service of convenience. It's not where we do a market survey and say it's going to be a great place to put a Chick-fil-A because I'm going to get a lot of traffic. But I think it's something that shows an investment in the community. And again, that's all relationship based. I didn't necessarily get it just because I was a sheriff, but because, you know, we have a vision and we have a plan to implement and we have a reputation now that allows us to do that.
You've had the substations. I mean, you've had the state of the art building now. And I know that you and a few other people have tried to get a registry for special needs people that didn't pass in the legislature, but that's sometimes you have to go back and get back up to bat, you know, and a second or third try might have. I think it's a really good idea.
Well, we're taking that actually. We're taking the bull by the horns here. And that was another one that tugs at my heartstrings. It doesn't necessarily have to do anything. It does, but not with, that's not a duty of mine as the sheriff per se, but I think it's an overall duty. We've got to take care of our most vulnerable, the most vulnerable. My wife is Facebook friends, I think, and this is the story, but she's Facebook friends with Tiffany Bailey Bowling, and they're friends of the family. And Miss Bowling has a special needs child, sweet, sweet kid, just a great family. But she had made a post on Facebook about a Florida bill that created this registry. And I had occasion, my wife brought it to my attention, and it was just one of those things that was so obvious, I couldn't believe that nobody had thought of it. And I had occasion a few days later to speak to Todd Kirby, who at the time was a delegate, and I ran it past him. It was on something completely different. And he said, yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know why we're not doing it. Not going to be a problem. All the Raleigh County delegates just jumped, you know, both feet on it because it was a good idea. It died in committee. And I told Miss Bowling that, but I just felt like, you know, really led because to me, in my mind, this was a mother that was trying to get help and nobody, you know, the state, whoever, and I still get a little bit emotional, wasn't listening. And I said, I'm not going to let this go. So we're doing it on county level. One of the folks that works with me in the RIT department is a special needs parent. He has an autistic son. So I asked him and he's kind of led the charge on that. And we're making a Raleigh County, and hopefully the state takes notice. Eric Brooks has already agreed to take this up next session, but we're making a Raleigh County voluntary registry where parents can, you know, they can fill out a form that we've designed with input from special needs parents. They can fill out a form. And my question to Tiffany was, what do you want to tell me about your son if you're not able to talk to me? And that's how she filled out this form. And it's not just, you know, it's not just law enforcement, it's anything. You know, you might have fire department come to the house and it's, you know, you can have a special needs sticker on your window, but if the glass is blown out or melted, that doesn't do any good. So what the hope is, and I've talked to John Zielinski at EOC, what the hope is once we get this, you know, the bugs worked out and get it implemented, if a first responder, law enforcement, EMS, fire is dispatched to your house, not only will we be able to say, you know, it's a blue house with this car in the driveway, but we'll also be able to know, you know, there's a special needs child here that may run to the lights, may try to get to the lights or get away or may not respond to a command. And, you know, from a law enforcement perspective, there's training now for all the newer ones that go through the academy on how to deal with mental emotional issues. And it doesn't make us experts, but it's just, I guess, an introduction to it. But it goes really hand in hand with that training. So if I'm responding to a house with a domestic and there's a, you know, a 19-year-old that's 6'2 and 230 pounds that's, say, beating on his grandmother, my response is going to be one way. If I know that this person is an autistic person that may not respond to commands, then my response is another way. And, you know, the whole time we're going to these calls, we're formulating different avenues in response. If this happens, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, because a lot of times we don't have time on scene to really formulate that plan. It's pretty quick. So yeah, I'm very, very happy about that.
That's good. That's a great idea. Now you got your reelection coming, yeah. or you've been involved with it, and you've never been in a political campaign, I don't guess.
No, sir. This is new.
And it's, I guess since the magistrate positions opened up, you've got 20 people running for magistrate. I've never seen so many signs in Raleigh County than that now.
West Virginia wildflower, I think.
Back in the old days, you know, somebody run for an office, they'd stick a card or something in their car or sign, and then they would pass out cards when you go to vote, which you can't do that anymore.
Right.
But there wasn't much to it. But now you've got the guys that are running for some of the smaller or less known offices that are, they got television ads, you've got radio ads, you've got the media, everything's going on. And it's kind of weird, but as an old coach, I get excited because I like to see the competition. And some of these guys are coming up with some creative mm-hmm. things, you know. And there's some good people out there. I mean, there's some good people that are running for office, and it's a shame that not all of them are going to get in.
Right.
But it's just the way the nature of the beast. In the sheriff race, you have two people running against you, and they're pretty good guys as far as I know. But you're the only guy that's got sheriff experience.
That's true.
But one of the things that I noticed both of the guys have brought up several times, and I was kind of curious. Of course, they were, you know, anytime you're talking about any kind of law enforcement, it's the drug situation, you know, and Beckley and Raleigh County and those kind of things. I really haven't seen I actually saw some facts this morning that the crime rate in Beckley had dropped the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, I was a little surprised myself. But one of the things that two guys running against you have brought up was the DARE program. And I didn't realize the DARE program was not in existence anymore. Is it federally funds drop, or what happened to that program?
You know, that actually went out before I was at least with the sheriff's department. I don't know what happened with the city. But it actually went out before I think I was, you know, in the detective bureau. We had a DARE officer, Rhonda Winders, and she went around, and I don't know exactly what she did. She was a captain and I was not, so it wasn't my job to keep up with her, but she was our DARE officer. And then it kind of went away, and nationally it went away for a while. And I think nationally it went away because, for the most part, I think there was a realization that at that time, and I think you have to realize that everything's not, it's you look at things in the time period that you're in. And at the time, DARE was not effective. That's why everybody got away from it. You know, it's good PR. It's good to have an officer in the schools. It's good to have people talking about drugs. But even you talk to graduates of the DARE program, what'd you get out of it? Well, not a lot. And I think that probably the studies at the time showed that overall it wasn't as effective as the people had hoped. I think that the thought process behind the DARE program is good, and I am not opposed at all to, and we have officers in the schools now that do interact with the kids. You know, we have deputies, city has city guys in the schools in the city. So we do have that interaction with the kids on a frequent basis. So it's not titled as a DARE program, and that's not all those guys do, and that's not something that they ride around in the DARE van and go school to school and just give drug presentations. But on a daily basis in the schools, we have deputies and the city has police officers that talk to kids about a whole multitude of things, whether mm-hmm. it's problems at home with family life or drugs or whatever. So to say that that's not going on, it's happening, it's just not under the auspices of a DARE program. I will say this, and this is one of the things that I learned, you know, when I was getting my master's degree, that the best chance of having a kid or somebody not get addicted to drugs is not necessarily rehabilitation, but it's more of a prehabilitation. Like the kids that are in the junior highs now and in the grade schools now, if we can keep them from getting into this mess, then that's the highest success rate. So having said that, I'm not opposed to trying a DARE program again. It comes down to more of a function of resources.
Sure.
And we have, like all law enforcement agencies, we're, I think, several short now, probably five or six short, and we have certain obligations, not just air, that we have to meet. That's one thing I've said several times, and that this is not just sheriff, but it's everywhere. Everybody that's trying to run for something is going to tell you pessimistically how bad the drugs are, how bad the crime is, how bad whatever they're running for is. And the people that are in office are going to say, no, it's great. It's none of that. I'm not a very good politician, so I'm just realistic. And folks can make their own decisions. You know, I believe people are capable enough without being spoon-fed. But the DARE program is not something that I'm opposed to. I'm willing to give it a shot because I think we're exporting our most valuable resource, which is our kids, when they're leaving here and going to work somewhere else. But we're also, you know, we have to try to protect our kids. And we talked about the special needs registry. We do, you know, at the sheriff's office, we started when I was chief deputy in the Internet Crimes Against Children unit, where we work with the FBI and we actually go after child predators. So I think we have to protect our children. If we can get resourced up enough with manpower, I think it's something that absolutely I'll take a swing at. I think that it's, you know, it's good. But we're in the schools now, but it's good to have a dedicated person and actually I'd like to have a person that can do a bunch of other community oriented things. I know I mentioned that we hadn't been the best partners in the community. Beckley has Beckley has really the same amount of people, but a much smaller area and a lot less responsibility overall than we do at the sheriff's office. We have a full contingent of folks that are bailiffs. We have people that are in the drug unit. We have detective bureau and the city does that as well, but they don't have necessarily the bailiff division or civil process or some of the things that we have. But yeah, I think that they having a person that not only does DARE, but also can do community relations, not just from the aspect of it makes the sheriff's department look good, but from the aspect of it lets us be able to sit down across somebody's table or, you know, at a McDonald's or something and have an interaction with the community. And I think that's a good thing. And I'll tell you I really had a lot of hope because, of course, we had COVID and then we had this whole defund the police movement. And really in Raleigh County and in West Virginia, maybe, but especially Southern West Virginia, people never really lost their minds with that garbage. Even at the worst, whenever everybody and their brother was defunding the police, and that really hurt everybody's ability to recruit whenever you had from the top down in the country talking about how poor the police were and how bad of a job we were doing and all this other stuff that was just not true. That really hurt our ability to recruit. Nobody wanted to get into this. I mean, you don't make any money and then you're armchair quarterback for the next 10 years on a decision that you have 3 seconds to make. But the people in our community weren't really like that. I mean, we had some, but it was not uncommon where, you know, we support you and we think you're doing a great job. And, you know, just, hey, you know, we're three or four of us are sitting at some restaurant somewhere and we go to pay and so-and-so that wants to remain anonymous picked up the bill. We had a lot of that. So I think that really re-energized our faith in the community because we were expecting to get beat up pretty bad. And law enforcement, you know, it's not like we didn't make any mistakes. We've made our own share of mistakes and brought some of that on ourselves. But I think here people just never, they still have sense, and that's a good place to work.
You haven't been in a campaign before, and you've got a full-time job. You've got two kids. You're getting ready to graduate. So you've got some plans there and plus daily life period. But between the ramp festivals or dinners and bingo and all this stuff, I mean, you've been a pretty busy guy anyway, but I go to a church, a pretty large church, and I've noticed several politicians that showed up at church I've never seen before. Yeah. And I would kind of feel a little hypocritical, I guess, but, you know, something like that. But you almost have to do it. You kind of got to get out there and let people see you and talk to you.
Coach, you do, and it's funny that you bring that up. Like I said, I'm probably not a very good politician. I'm not very good at that. So, And I've been told, you know, you go do this and you go do that. And some folks are going to 2 and 3 church services a day. And I think you're right. But so here's my thing. if I'm invited somewhere, if your church wants me to come and speak about whatever, hey, you're running for sheriff, or, you know, we did this thing back in the fall. It was called Faith in Blue. I thought it was, you know, really important, not politics wise, but just to show, hey, we need the church. I'm a Christian. And as the leader of this department, I want the folks that work for me or the county folks to know this is where I stand on this stuff. So we went to churches, several of them, as a matter of fact, and just had forums, maybe in place of a Sunday service, where we just had an interaction with the pastor, with members of the congregation, and tried to enlist churches to be the pillars of the community that they should be, but also to work with us that way. So I kind of said all that to say this. I try not to, for the reasons that you've mentioned. This campaign, whether it's for me another 6 months or another 4 years, is a very small portion of my life. Like, Lord willing, I've got a lot of life to live after this. And I'm not going to compromise my values or do something that, you know, I'm ashamed of. Because let's be honest, after a campaign, and I don't do what you're talking about with the church. Like I said, if somebody invites me to come speak somewhere, I do. Yeah, the ramp dinners are fine, and I like that. My wife threatens me with them, but I still go. Because that's not something that's uncommon for me. Like, I would, you know, I enjoy stuff like that without being sheriff. But I'm not, if I were going to three or four church services, that's not something that I can keep up for the rest of my life. And so I'm not going to do it. So how weird does that look that I'm coming to your church and this church and that church? And then all of a sudden, you know, in June, I've picked a church. Yeah, you're right. You have to do that. But there are certain things that I just have a personal problem with myself. And I'm not saying that people that do those are wrong. I'm just saying with me, I understand where you're coming from, because that's how I feel if you see that. So I don't do it.
Well, I'm, you know, one of the things that I appreciate, and that I, to my knowledge, you and the two guys that you're running against have kept a pretty clean campaign. I haven't heard anything derogatory about the person or whatever, and I appreciate that kind of stuff, because you don't get that on every level.
No, you don't. And I think, you know, even as a person, because yeah, I'm running for sheriff, but you know, if you go down my hierarchy, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a husband, I'm a dad, I'm a son. You know, sheriff is not, you know, so as a normal person, I agree, and you just don't want to see that stuff. I mean, let's talk about, don't tell me why I shouldn't elect somebody else. That's not what I need to know. I want to know what your qualifications are. And you know, I've known both those guys for years. But at least from where I sit, when I talked to my wife about doing this, I said two things, really. I said, one, I'm not running against either one of those guys. I'm running because I think I'm the most qualified guy to lead the sheriff's department. So that was one thing. The other thing was, you know, I said, if the good Lord means for me to do this, there's nothing anybody can do. And if he doesn't mean for me to do this, there's nothing that I can do. So when one door opens or one door closes, another door opens, if he doesn't mean for me to do this, something, there's another direction. And, you know, I'm okay with that. So that's how I keep my sanity, is I think you have to do your best, again, from sports always. And I think the Lord expects you to do your best. He wants to see that you're trying to do something. But at the same time, I look at it in the context of God has a plan and I fit somewhere. Is this it? I hope so, but it may not be.
Well, it brings me back to my favorite quote, to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift.
That's right.
And well, Jim, I appreciate you coming by and talking to me. I've enjoyed it. And I've learned a lot, too. And you're welcome to come back anytime.
Sure. I'll come back anytime. We can talk about whatever except my wrestling record, maybe. We don't want to spend a lot of time on that.
You're a compassionate guy. You're a proven leader. And I wish you the best of luck. Like I said, you've got an open door. Welcome anytime you want to come. And anybody else out there that would like to be on our program, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com. And remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. This is Wayne Bennett, and God bless you.